I'm going to jump up and read a scripture since Tom's not here tonight. I'm going to read a couple of them, actually. First one's from Colossians chapter 1, verse 17. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And then from the Gospel of John, verses 1 through 3. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And he was in the beginning with God. All things came into being by him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being.
Okay, I guess we'll get right into it. We're looking at a six-part series on the case for creation, and this is part two. We're going to look at cause and effect. We're opening the passage from the scriptures in Job 37. Scriptures do deal with cause and effect, you know, a lot. Job said, whether for correction or for his world or for loving kindness, he causes it to happen. And God is in control, and this is one of the things that we contend, that there is a super mind, a superpower behind all things going on, and it is the ultimate cause of reality, and men should look to him instead of their own efforts. As part of the introduction, the creation-evolution question is hardly a trivial issue that concerns only a few scientists on the one hand and a few religionists on the other. In one way or another, the issue permeates practically every field of academic study and every aspect of national life. Anybody that's been in school realizes how much it's predominant of the courses I took in psychology. I don't know how they managed it, but just about every book we went through, the first chapter had to deal with Freud and evolution. Which raises a problem. Say for the psychologist, psychiatrist, if your position is that man came up, through the lower animals, how do you counsel him? Do you treat him as an animal, giving, like Skinner's methods, you try to teach him, primarily through behavioral modification, give him a doggy treat every time he does the right thing. Or if you look at man as, the creation of God, so that you counsel him in order to get back to what God wants him to be. There's a big challenge there. As for another field, even government, a lot of money gets poured into projects trying to prove the evolutionary theory, trying to find life on other planets. The money could be better spent on other things. Someone just pointed out recently that just in the way we approach things, in our government, the progressive mindset of the liberal, which is socialism, and the academia and those in government power look at themselves as the elite that need to tell the rest of us what to do, because we're too stupid, to figure it out for ourselves. So when you get more and more of government taking control of things, it gets away from what our nation was set up on of God's principles and trying to teach us to be gracious and giving people. In fact, that's what the contribution's for, in essence, teaching us to give cheerfully. So that we begin to experience that and understand the effect it has on us and others. Where that comes into conflict recently that was pointed out was in the problem of Katrina down in New Orleans, and where on the one hand, I can recall, Red Cross gets in. I mean, it's, people donating stuff, and it moves in right away to help people. And I can remember the Churches of Christ, giving and donating articles and stuff like that for the churches there. In fact, at one point, they had to say, quit giving stuff. We got more than we need. Whereas when the government was trying to move in, FEMA was stopped at the borders. waiting for permission to go in. And the opposite number, you know, that's the federal government, and the opposite number on the state level, they had to wait for permission from him, but he couldn't give it because he was in jail for corruption. And so everything on the government level bogged down, whereas when people just took it in their own hands to do things, to be charitable, to be loving, to be giving, things got done in on a better way. And so there's conflicts there. So we're going to be running into these problems all over the place. So it is important to know these things. And it does matter what you believe, because it affects everything around you. It deals with two opposing worldviews. Consequently, it is or should be of interest to everybody. And that's why we're getting into this series. What is more alarming are the desperate lengths that reputable men are willing to go to when their foundation of perspective is being threatened. In an article by British physicist H.S. Lipson that appeared in the May 1980 issue of Physics Bulletin, he wrote, "In fact, evolution became, in essence, a scientific religion." And it is, it should be thought that way. I think even the Supreme Court at one point made that judgment, that evolution is a religion. Almost all scientists have accepted it, and many are prepared to bend their observations to fit with it. He then adds, "To my mind, the theory does not stand up at all." And we're going to be looking at more of that perspective, because too many people think that, well, all scientists have accepted it, and all scientists haven't. What is happening is that many scientists are beginning to realize that the former hollow laws of science are turning out to be more supportive of the creation model. That is, the ones that are truly recognized as laws and not science fiction, really support the creation model. And that's what we're going to be looking at through these series. The result is that the laws of science are now under attack. In this lesson, we will demonstrate the nature of this attack on the law of causality and why it supports creation. Now, this stuff's a little dated. I think, you know, science has probably made more inroads now, you know, and more people are just ignoring a lot of the evidence in their own, you know, colleagues, but you can still look at this as good, solid stuff. As the law of cause and effect, we touched some of it last week, indisputably the most universal and most certain of scientific laws is the laws of cause and effect, or as it is commonly known, the law of causality. In science, laws are seen as reflecting actual regularities in nature. And that's all science is. I mean, Hume pointed this out in 1974, that, you know, all scientists should be doing is going, what's out there? What do we see? What do we observe? What can we measure? And that should be the basis of their science, not a lot of theories that are unsupported. The law has been stated many ways. It could be everything that happens or begins to be presupposes something which it follows according to rule. That's Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. That's almost 100 years ago. Nothing happens without a reason why it should happen rather than not happen. Von Mises, if you can follow this stuff. Sometimes philosophers, a little hard for me to follow sometimes. But, you know, they're saying the same thing. In fact, Mises goes on, "Also observed, we may only add that almost all philosophers regard the law of causality as the most important." So we're starting off with this one. This is a big thing. Big proof. "There is hardly a more useful and more reliable rule of behavior than to assume of any occurrence that we come to know that some other one preceded it as its cause." Okay, something happens. I mean, think of it. Yeah, just normal flow. Okay, you woke up from your nap. Who knows, you know, what woke you up? Maybe your alarm clock. That was a cause. And the effect was you woke up. And there's other causes involved. You realize you had to come to church. So that realization caused you to get dressed, to eat, get prepared, to get in the car. You turned on the ignition. That was a cause that started the engine. You put the car in gear, which was a cause that had the effect of getting the car to go forward. You know, cause and effect is all over the place. Simply put, the law of causality states that every material effect must have an adequate antecedent, that means something that preceded it, cause. So anytime you see anything in motion, anything moving, whatever, that's an effect. And it had to have something causing it. Obviously, then, if every material effect has an adequate antecedent cause, and if the universe, we're making little logic points here, if the universe is a material effect, then it had to have an initial cause. How did the universe get here? We also know, as stated in the former lesson, that the effect is never quantitatively greater than or qualitatively superior to the cause. That is, you know, as we look at the universe, all the power that's displayed in it, we're going to find greater power in God. Has to be that way. As he is going to be the first cause, he has to be more powerful than the universe he created. That should be a little humbling to us to begin with. In fact, part of what Ron was reading, he caused the creation. He created all things. Yeah, it's for him and by him. Also, all the intellect that's in the universe, all the smarts, all the high IQ points, whatever, none of it can be greater than that which is possessed by God. Since he is the source of all wisdom, his wisdom has to be greater than anything that's displayed. He didn't tell us everything. Okay? And that's what we want to go to heaven for, to find out all that we're missing. Yeah. What we know is just probably a small little part. Yeah. And it's going to be a great enthusiastic joy, you know, to see all that God has to offer. The attacks on the law of causality, you think there is some? You know, scientists even attack it. They have to, because it supports the creation model. Perhaps the most famous skeptic of the law of cause and effect was the British empiricist David Hume. However, as fervent as Hume was in his criticism, he never went so far as to assert that cause and effect did not exist. He was trying to slam it as much as he could as anything, you know, worthwhile to bring out, you know, to prove creation. He simply felt that it was not empirically verifiable and stemmed instead from a priori considerations. I was trying to think of something to kind of get the point across. And it's like the axiom, 1 + 1 = 2. Do you believe that? Has it ever been proven to you? If you had to prove that 1 + 1 = 2, could you do it? Can you lay out the logic? Can you lay out the math? Can you have some sort of, you know, reasoning that you can apply that shows 1 + 1 = 2? Well, most people just, you know, accept it, you know, as an axiomatic fact. It doesn't need proving. It seems to be sort of self-evident. And is the law of cause and effect. Another way that causality has been attacked is the argument that insists that the principle must be false because it is inconsistent with itself. How do they do that? If the principle of cause and effect says that everything must have a cause, it traces everything back to a first cause where it suddenly stops. So why is it that the first cause did not likewise need a cause? Why does the principle stop there? And they find the flaw there. Okay, in defense of this, there are two responses that may be offered to the complaint about causality. First, it is impossible logically to defend any concept of infinite regress that postulates an endless series of effects with no ultimate first cause. We did that in the first, you know, that's one of the things, you know, that was a possibility, that just everything's been going on as it's always gone on. But that's been kind of rejected out of hand. It doesn't help us. Yeah. In fact, in a scientific arena of entropy where things, start a car, and get it going, and then take your hands off, or your feet off the brake, and what happens to the car? Eventually, all the forces working on it bring it to a dead stop. At some point, if the universe, was just let to go, it should have stopped a long time ago. There's got to be something that's keeping it going. In fact, even something that started to begin with. Whatever begins to exist must have a cause. Nothing causeless happens. So what's the other answer? Second, the complaint offered by the skeptics suggesting that the law of causality is inconsistent with itself is not a valid objection against the law. Rather, it is an objection to an incorrect statement of it. If someone were to say everything must have a cause, then the object might be valid, but this is not what the law of causality says. It states that every material effect must have an adequate antecedent cause. Okay. We talked about later, there's matter, but there's something else in the universe besides matter, and it's most evident in us. We are made up of matter. But what makes us move? And we showed that last week, there's scientific validation now that we've discovered that there's such a thing as mind. The will of man. You just think, and there's nothing that can start it, just some sort of intent, some sort of something in you that conjures up a desire to do something. And there's no way of figuring out, how you get a cause to a desire or an intent or a will. Where does it spring from? In fact, the synapses in the brain fire before anything mechanical or physical starts, as far as we can record. So the mind starts the material. And in fact, Joe pointed out last week, there's something else to think about. The mind also stops the material. That's another aspect of it. So what started the material universe? The mind of God. Or as Gessner, Reasons for Faith, 1967, correctly reasoned, because every effect must have a cause, there must ultimately be one cause that is not an effect, but pure cause. Or how indeed can one explain effects? A cause that is itself an effect could not explain anything, but must require another explanation. Again, we're going ad infinitum into causes. But the argument has shown that the universe as we know it is an effect and cannot itself be self-explanatory. It cannot cause itself. Material can't do that. I mean, this pulpit, piece of wood, cannot make anything else. I can make the pulpit, but the pulpit as material cannot conjure up something else. Cannot pick up tools, it cannot make whatever. It requires something to explain it, which is not itself an effect. There must be an uncaused cause, and that point, stands. There has to be something that wasn't caused, something that's not material, that doesn't fit in with that pattern. Because of this, there's been changes of the evolutionary mind. People were starting to come around. Scientists were starting to come around. Very important scientists were starting to come around. I think this is one of my favorite ones. On November 5th, 1981, Colin Paterson, senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History in London, and one of the world's foremost evolutionary experts, delivered an address to his evolutionist colleagues at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. This is what he had to say. He astonished his colleagues by saying, "One morning I woke up and something had happened in the night." The old subconscious at work, putting all the things together. And it struck me that I had been working on this stuff for 20 years and there was not one thing I knew about it. And this is leading expert. That's quite a shock to learn that one can be misled for so long. Not if you have help. Dr. Patterson went and asked the simple question, can you tell me, this is in New York, can you tell me anything that you know about evolution, any one thing that is true? Prestigious body of evolutionists. And this was to the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History, and the only answer he got was silence. Nobody spoke up. Nobody had anything to offer. When Dr. Patterson tried the same question at the Evolutionary Morphology Seminar at the University of Chicago, a very prestigious body of evolutionists, he got the same silence. Until one person finally said, it does seem that the level of knowledge about evolution is remarkably shallow. We know it ought not to be taught in high school, and that's all we know about it. Pierre Paul Grasset, the man whose knowledge of the living world has been called encyclopedic, authored The Evolution of Living Organisms, in which he stated, today, our duty is to destroy the myth of evolution. Considered as a simple, understood, and explained phenomena which keeps rapidly unfolding before us. It doesn't. Has anybody seen anything evolve? Anything appear out of nothing? I mean, science is supposed to be an observable thing, something that you can recreate, in the lab, whatever. And none of that is possible with evolution. This is why it has to be a religion. In fact, Kirkut once said that it requires more faith to be an evolutionist than it does to be a creationist. Success among certain biologists, philosophers and sociologists, notwithstanding, the explanatory doctrines of biological evolution do not stand up to an objective, in-depth criticism. This is still a quotation going on. They prove to be either in conflict with reality, which a lot of evolution is, or else incapable of solving the major problems involved. I think this is the last part of it. I'm going to go out with, something. When I was I took a biology class fairly recently, just before I moved up here. And my teacher was a professor at the University, Irvine, UC Irvine. And we were supposed to report on what our term paper was going to be on. And I said, my term paper is going to be on the problems of evolution. He says, go for it. So what I did was I took the book that we had as a text and used it as an argument against evolution because it had everything in it. It lays out all the different scientific principles, and with that, you can refute the fictitious laws that evolution has. In fact, he told me, since he was going to do a lecture in France, that when he started to grade the things, he said, I'll let you know, I went down to finders in the stack to pull that out to read it first. Okay. I got an A- on it. The reason I got the minus is because he didn't quite believe the statistics that were in it. About, we'll get into that, statisticians, think that the odds of evolution occurring is like a tornado going through a junk pile and, building a 747 or something like that. He said, I doubted your mathematics. And I said, well, it's not really mine. I got them out of a statistics book, another course I'm taking at the same time. Evidently, statisticians do not believe in evolution. The math doesn't work. And we'll get into that a little bit later. The universe is here. Life in our magnificent universe is here. Intelligence is here. Morality is here. What is their ultimate cause? Since the effect is never prior or superior to the cause, it stands to reason that the cause of life must be both antecedent to and more powerful than the universe. A living intelligence, a powerful intelligence, that itself is of a moral nature. Yeah, that's the only way you can explain morality. Our God has to have all these qualities, an aesthetic quality, a moral quality, a reasoning ability, in order to impute it into his creation. Now, why I also brought up the part of the paper is just sort of a suggestion on way to, in fact, it made him a little bit more amenable because of the way I ended it. So it's not so much that I'm forcing you to accept creation, once I've totally shattered evolution. In fact, one of the things that was kind of off, how consistent, is the timing? When they tell you, we've been here so many billion years. One of the things I pointed out that the book said we've been here 4.6 billion years. The lab book said 4.1 billion. What's 500,000 years between friends? Or million years between friends? What I said is, basically, in fact, the way perhaps to approach the scientist is to say, if you accept evolution, which is full of holes, bad theories, and everything else, you're really accepting it because it's the only alternative you have to accept God. But what is this doing to you? It's shutting down your mind in case there's ever a third alternative that comes up. Maybe there is a solution that doesn't involve God or evolution. But you'll never know it because your mind's already biased into the pseudoscience of evolution. And I think, made him open up a little bit. And I think it'll help others too. This is the problem. They've bought into it so much that it closes down their ability to think and to reason and to be open to anything else. And hopefully, if we can get them to be open to a third possibility, that openness of mind and that now ability fresh to go into research things will open them up also to the possibility of the divine beginning. And that really it is God who is the reality and the first cause. Get down on a personal level, God still needs to be a cause in our lives. For some of us, he hasn't had a beginning yet. We need to think on that. As God began to make inroads into our thinking, into our acceptance of reality, in the way we perceive things, for the Christian, there's always room to grow in this thinking. What Paul told the Athenians, again, it's in him we live and move and have our being. Do you actually think about it that way? We would understand immersion if we were dunked into a pool of water. Okay. Now you're living and moving in the water and having your being. You're completely surrounded by it. And you'll see how it affects you, whether you can breathe or not. You notice your movements are more retarded. And you come to realize you're totally in a different atmosphere. Conversely, the Christian should begin to realize that he is in a different atmosphere. But it's a lot more liberating. It's a lot more blessed, wondrous. A person that lives in Christ lives in a better world, in a better environment, a more sane environment, a more loving environment, a more caring environment. A more powerful environment. God is in your life. He's answering prayers. He's helping you through life, directing you, guiding you into a better place, a greater life still to come. And so it's a question that we need to consider for ourselves. How much do we think, we may not accept the evolution or the pseudoscience, but have we really accepted the concept of God as our creator, is someone who made everything for him? Do we consider ourselves as individuals whose life should be centered around serving our Lord and offer ourselves in service to him? That's a lot to think about and a lot to let dawn on us. And until we begin to truly understand that, we're not going to be much help to ourselves and others around us to bring God into their lives. So if there's anything we can do to help, or if you want to begin that journey this very evening, the invitation is extended. We hope you'll come as we stand to sing.